We're in London, and it's sometime in the 16th century. Christmas is coming, and preparations are in swing. That means, among other things, that the king and houses of high status are selecting a Lord of Misrule to act as a master of merry disports. Shoppers visit the markets for meat, nuts, dried fruit, and everywhere, greenery. A symbol of verdancy against the bare landscape, a festive decoration, possibly even a touch of defiance against the cold, lifeless winter. It wasn't always this way. For centuries, festive greenery harkened back to pre-Christian wintertime festivals. It would have been uncommon or even blasphemous to have it at Christmas. Even once people came around to the idea, there were still strict rules about what kinds of greenery were appropriate and in which settings. Each plant, whether holly, ivy, pine, fir, rosemary, mistletoe, had its own set of legends, associations, and superstitions, the kinds of things that tend to die hard. Holly, for instance, was allowed inside the church, whereas ivy was only allowed outside. Ivy was also banned from the inside of homes for a time. But by the time we get to our London Christmas in the 16th century, all that has changed. Greenery of all kinds dominates the visual identity of Christmas. In his 1598 book, The Survey of London, author John Stowe writes,
"Against the feast of Christmas, every man's house, as also the parish churches, were decked with holm, ivy, bays, and whatsoever the season of the year afforded to be green. The conduits and standards in the streets were likewise garnished."
Now let's jump forward a bit in time and about 60 miles northwest of London. Now we're in Oxfordshire. And like anywhere else in England, holly and ivy are to Christmas then what the Christmas tree is today. No respectable English home is properly decorated without it. And ivy, in particular, had become the source of some mischievous merrymaking. Indeed, to be caught without it was to be caught with your pants down. Or up, in this case. In the December issue of Harper's New Monthly Magazine in 1884, writer Charles Dudley Warner reported on this strange and devious custom from Christmas past.
"In some places in Oxfordshire, it was the custom for the maidservant to ask the man for ivy to dress the house, and if the man refused or neglected to fetch the ivy, the maid stole a pair of his breeches and nailed them up to the gate in the garden or highway."
Talk about having your laundry aired in public. Why should ivy have come to receive such revered status at Christmas time, where to lack ivy was to risk public humiliation? Why are holly and ivy so often mentioned together? It's a story involving ancient festivals, cemeteries, superstitions, and a battle of the sexes, of sorts. I'm Brian Earle. This is Christmas Past. Ivy is a bit of a turnaround story. It has a long history of association with Bacchus, the Roman god of wine. It featured in the festivities of Bacchanalia, the celebration honoring Bacchus. Some people even thought it to be an antidote for drunkenness. And there was a smattering of superstitions or supposed medicinal uses for ivy. It was also commonly associated with death, due to it being a common sight in English cemeteries. So, for a long time, ivy mainly conjured images of all things pagan, superstitious, gluttonous, debauched, and morbid. So much so that it would be forbidden from Christian homes. Centuries later, though, that symbolism had worn off, and a new one took hold. It was based on the very nature of ivy as a plant that clings and climbs. Ivy was rebranded as an emblem of fidelity and humans' dependence on God for strength. And for Christians, the appeal of ivy or any evergreen during the winter celebration was largely the same as it ever was.
They were symbols of everlasting life because they just stayed green all throughout the year.
That's Sue Hunter. She's a nursery owner, educator, and spokesperson for the American Ivy Society, which has been around since 1973. And yes, among the cold dormancy of winter, evergreens stood out as symbols of life and renewal. Or, if nothing else, they just look nice when everything else looked dreary. That's a notion that can be embraced by any culture that experiences long winters, regardless of whatever other beliefs that culture may have. Still, it would be a long time before anybody embraced ivy as a Christmas decoration. And when the English eventually did, they initially restricted it to outdoor use, favoring holly for the indoors. Now, holly and ivy are something of a dynamic duo at Christmas time. Even though they weren't allowed inside a church together, they still have a special connection to each other in Christian tradition.
Holly and Ivy go together at Christmas time. One usually doesn't think of one without the other.
Their pairing is even the subject of a traditional carol, the Holly and the Ivy. But why is that? Well, in addition to being readily available evergreen plants, they also have complementary associations.
The holly is seen as the male. The ivy is seen as the female. The holly has a strong, upright appearance, whereas the ivy intertwines and is graceful and flowing.
Now, I'm sorry to be that guy, but it does bear mentioning that the kind of holly that produces a berry, the kind associated with Christmas, is actually the female variety of that plant. But accurately or not, that male-female association persists. And when it comes to Christian symbolism, we're not just talking about any male and female. Holly is said to represent Jesus, and ivy to represent Mary. In fact, of the six traditional verses of the Holly and the Ivy, each verse compares some quality of holly, blood-red berries, thorn-like prickles, pure white flowers, to the story of Jesus.
And it certainly reinforces that thought about holly and ivy representative of eternal life, especially during the bleak winter time.
If you're familiar with the song, you know that the lyrics focused mostly on holly. Now, if you want a carol that goes all in for ivy, you're in luck. Though it's not as well known as the Holly and the Ivy, the 15th century carol Ivy Chief of Trees commemorates ivy's revered status. That beautiful rendition was from the Granta Chorale, conducted by Janet Wheeler and composed and arranged by Sarah Catley. Thanks to all of them for letting me share that with you here. Anyway, holly and ivy as a Christmas symbol and a religious symbol is still very common today.
Surprisingly, there's still, you know, many churches that do observe celebrations using holly and ivy.
And lest you think that all that superstitious belief died out with the post-pagan embrace of ivy, well, not so fast. For example, in Shropshire, on the English border of Wales, it was tradition on Christmas Day to feed a piece of ivy to animals to keep the evil spirits away for the coming year. Other beliefs included using ivy for romantic fortune-telling and attracting wealth. And all greenery, including ivy, was to be burned or removed from the home by a certain date, such as January 6th, the Epiphany, to avoid bad luck. Yes, ivy is still common at Christmas time, and for all the same reasons it ever was. But as time has gone on, it's no longer one of the dominant greeneries, having been replaced, of course, by the Christmas tree. Well, one thing that's not getting replaced is families gathering to make memories at Christmas and practice their favorite traditions, just like Zach in New York.
Hello, everyone. My name is Zach. I'm from Binghamton, New York. I hope everyone is enjoying their holiday season so far. I'd like to share a couple holiday memories with you. First, on Christmas Eve, every year for as long as I can remember, my parents would give my sister and myself a ornament. Started our collection early. We now have quite an assortment of ornaments, I must say, which hold a special place in our hearts. And next is every Christmas morning. Once again, as long as I can remember, we had homemade cinnamon buns when we were opening our stockings. There is nothing better than a hot, fresh, homemade cinnamon bun on Christmas morning with or without the stocking. I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season. Enjoy.
Christmas will be here before you know it. There's just over a week to go, but there's still time for you to share a Christmas memory with the rest of the Christmas Past family. Just record yourself speaking into your phone's voice memo app and send it to christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Keep it reasonably short, clean, and family-friendly, and be sure to say your name and where you're from. Christmas Past is produced in wonderful Willow Glen, California, by yours truly, Brian Earle. Thank you so much to Sue Hunter. Thanks also to Peter Coates for doing the voiceover at the top of this episode. Thanks once again to the Grand de Corral, Janet Wheeler, and Sarah Catley. Thanks to Zachary in New York, and as always, thank you for listening. You can drop me a line anytime. I always love to hear from you. Again, I'm at ChristmasPastPodcast@gmail.com or connect on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And do join our private Christmas Past Facebook group if you haven't yet. And hey, if you're really feeling the Christmas spirit, why not help more people discover the show? It's as simple as telling a friend about it or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. If you do leave a review, I'll send you a Christmas Past sticker, and a handwritten Christmas card is my way of saying thanks. Reach out for details. And until we meet again, may your days be merry and bright.